Johnson, Mr. Robbins. Where's your opponent? Where's Ms. Bonamici?
She was here earlier, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, you can go ahead. We're not going to wait for her.
Shall I proceed?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Good morning, Your Honor. Michael Robbins on behalf of Antoine Johnson. This is an appeal from the denial of a motion to suppress. The district court conducted an extensive hearing, following which the court rejected the testimony of the police officers and found that they gave less than credible testimony, and that the justification they offered, the plain view justification for the search of the defendant and the passengers, was not the case. And the court ruled that the search of the defendant was illegal and that of the passengers as well. The court then asked for additional briefing on other issues and ultimately denied the motion predicated on his finding that the defendant did not have standing to contest the searches of his passengers' persons. Now, what's interesting about this case, I think, is that both parties cite to the fact that the searches were contemporaneous with one another, that is, the search of the defendant and the passengers, but draw different conclusions from the temporal proximity of those searches. And I want to say early on that there is a good deal of attention was paid to the theory of the independent basis, but the court, I think, correctly rejected that as a basis for justifying the searches because there was no independent means by which the police officers could have lawfully gotten the evidence that they recovered from the passengers, aside and apart from the illegal search of the defendant rising out of the traffic stop. And this is only in the technical sense of traffic stop. You'll recall that the car was viewed by the officers allegedly to be too many inches
from the curb. Well, the government's argument is that Johnson can't complain about the illegal search
exactly.
of Batchelor
exactly.
and Cooper.
But in looking at this, the government's argument...
And wasn't that the district court's ground? I don't...
I'm sorry, Judge?
Wasn't that the district court's ground?
That lack of standing.
Right, yeah. So the lack of standing, and therefore, since it was going to come in...
That's correct, yes. He summarily rejected the inevitable discovery rule and said that the defendant did not have standing. And the argument that I'm advancing here is that the government has argued, or let me put it this way, the government has argued that although the searches were contemporaneous, that the evidence was not obtained as a direct result of the illegal detention of the defendant, and that the searches of the passengers were independent events from that of the search of the driver. And they went on to argue, I think just completely illogically, if I may, that the police did not exploit the traffic stop to get to the evidence they illegally found on the part of the passengers.
So your argument has to be that this is all just so intertwined, because if it is, then I can see that the government gets to introduce all the evidence with respect to each of them. It has an illegal search, but B can't complain about the evidence found for A and C can't complain about the evidence found for A and B, and A can't complain about the evidence found for B and C. So all three of them have evidence that was illegally seized. And if these were independent events, then perhaps it makes some sense. But if it's really all one package...
That is my argument, that it's one continuous event, and they acknowledge they occurred contemporaneously. But there's an interesting aspect to this, I think, and that is the passengers of a vehicle that is the subject of a traffic stop stand in something of a unique position vis-a-vis Terry. It's in effect an exception to Terry. If these were citizens walking down the street or found elsewhere, the police would need some degree of articulable suspicion before they could detain citizens and, of course, pat them down. Passengers who are in a car that's the subject of a traffic stop, there is no articulable suspicion. There is no Terry requirement. The police have the right to order the passengers out of the car, detain them, and pat them down solely and exclusively as a result of the fact that they're involved as passengers in a traffic stop. This traffic stop promptly became illegal immediately upon the defendant having presented his license and registration. At that point, the police officers no longer even arguably had any basis to detain anyone. But at that point, they ordered the defendant out of the car. Contemporaneously with that, the passengers were ordered out, and the searches then contemporaneously occurred. So there is nothing independent of the searches of the passengers from that of the search of the driver. And it all arose out of the traffic stop. And were it not for the traffic stop, there would have been certainly no basis upon which the police officers could have detained or searched these passengers. So I think the temporal proximity of these searches and the fact that the police, by virtue of the interpretation of the laws that applies to passengers at a traffic stop, confers a special interest upon a driver. Once he's proven that he has a license, that he is a licensed driver and has registration, it would seem to me that he then has a reasonable basis to ensure that the vehicle and his passengers are not searched illegally, which is what took place here.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Robbins. Ms. Bonamici?
Good morning, Your Honor. This case does really flow from the issue of standing, and that's
what happened to Batchelor and Cooper?
I'm sorry?
What happened to the other two, Batchelor and Cooper?
Batchelor and Cooper, as far as I remember from the record, were not pursued in the same case. As you recall from looking at the record, there were two cases that were pursued with respect to Mr. Johnson that ultimately were resolved. The drug case and the counterfeit case were handled separately initially, and only when they were put together did those issues come together before a single judge. But the question...
My question is, what happened to Batchelor and Cooper? Not how many cases there were against Johnson.
With respect to Batchelor and Cooper, they were... Actually, I believe that they were prosecuted stateside, if my recollection
they
is
were
right.
They were what? Prosecuted by the state?
Yes.
And did they raise issues of illegal searches, or you don't know?
I do not know that.
You don't know what, whether they were convicted or this or that?
I don't know anything about that piece.
Now, your position is, isn't it, that the evidence against the drugs collected from the search of Johnson, or his car, or whatever it was, they could be used against Batchelor and Cooper, and Batchelor and Cooper's drugs against Johnson. Isn't that your position?
Yes, it would be, Your Honor.
So this means that the police can make an illegal arrest of a group, and they can use the evidence, so there are five people, can use the evidence of the other four against one and the other four against the other and so on. So there's no penalty for the illegal, as long as the mass arrest, there's no penalty for the illegal arrest.
Right, and that's my concern as well. It's a neat way of eliminating the exclusionary rule when there's a mass arrest, because that arrest can be as illegal as it wants to be, but by manipulating the standing rules, there's no exclusion that results. Well, I agree that that's potentially a problem, but I would have two responses to it. And the first one is, that really does not present a distinct issue from the one that you face in every standing question, which is the police do not suffer a penalty. I mean, if you can focus on the police piece. There's no deterrent, though. I mean, of course, every exclusionary rule case has aspects of, you know, what effect on police behavior you may have, what effect on the criminal justice system you may have. But I can't find any cases from the Supreme Court, at least, that have tolerated this pattern where there was actually an illegal search, we'll say for the sake of argument, vis-a-vis these other people. Well, obviously the government's position below, and it still is, that the search was not illegal at any point. But taking it from the standpoint...
But you're not challenging those findings.
No, we're not. That's correct. You have to argue this on the basis of the rule of law that you want to see come out of this case is, no matter how illegal the search is with respect to the other people involved, all of the evidence comes in as long as there's a group.
Well, I don't agree with that, Your Honor, and here's the other point.
Where are you going to limit it then?
Well, I think it's an unusual situation where, and we're assuming a lot in making this or having this discussion, you assume that the evidence
that was illegally seized from one defendant would be relevant to charges that were brought against another.
Look, there are three people. They all have drugs or money or what have you, other evidence. They're arrested together. So, of course the drugs found on one are relevant to the case against the other and vice versa.
Well, I'll give you an example. If there was evidence in the trunk of the car, if there was no basis for tying evidence that was
sure,
in the trunk of the car to one of the
you can change the case, but this is a case in which it turns out that on your view of the independent source doctrine, the police pay no price for the illegal arrests.
Well, I understand what you're saying, and I don't really disagree with that aspect of it, but I don't think that you can distinguish that result from the same result that pertains in every case. Because the independent source doctrine normally assumes that it's a legitimate independent source. What I'm talking about is just basic standing rules. If there's an illegal seizure and the evidence is admissible against another person who lacks standing to contest it.
But it's not admissible against the person.
Well, that's right.
But if you have this, maybe this is an unusual situation, but that's all right. We can have a rule for an unusual situation where because both of the parties illegally arrested have evidence that is germane to the other, the police have all the evidence they need as a result of these illegal searches, and there's no penalty.
Well,
why not have a rule limited to that case?
Well, I don't think that's the best plan, and here's why.
Why not?
Because the rule of standing has a purpose, and the purpose of that rule is to balance the public's interest in appropriate conduct on the part of the police on one hand, and having available in a criminal case all of the evidence that pertains to guilt or innocence. The public has an interest in both of those things. And what the standing rule does is that it balances those two.
Not in a case like this. In this case, there's no balance.
Well,
because in this case, there is no cost to the police of the illegal search, whereas in the ordinary standing case, there is.
Well,
they lose
no
one potential defendant. In this case, they don't lose anybody.
Mm-hmm. But that happens in standing cases all the time, regardless of whether you're applying
no,
an independent source.
No, standing cases usually presume that there is a person who does have standing who will be able properly to raise the issue to the court, and whatever consequences come from that will come. Whereas in this case, there isn't anybody.
Well, I agree that this is an unusual situation, but what I don't agree is that it presents unusual enough circumstances that it makes sense to make an exception to the standing rule that it pertains in every other case. And the reason, I repeat...
Well, standing alone isn't enough, though. You still can't get the evidence in unless it counts as an independent source, and if independent sources have to be legitimate...
Well, that's the question right there, is whether the independent source has to be legitimate. Because I think the facts are very clear in this case that the evidence at issue was not obtained by an exploitation of illegal conduct.
Well, by a violation of the Fourth Amendment, perhaps. Surely a constitutional violation counts for something.
Well, and I don't mean to belittle that, but what I'm saying is there's no question that the evidence at issue was not...
But look, everything here is illegal, so you're using two illegalities to create legality in both prosecutions. That's ridiculous, actually, it seems to me.
Well, I understand your point, but what you're going to have to do in order to make that happen is you're going to have to say that in a case like this one, or basically you'll have to...
All we have to say is two illegalities don't make a legality.
Well, what you're really saying, though...
No, I'm really saying. I'm saying what I'm saying.
Okay. But here's another way of saying your point, and that is...
Well, I like my way.
Well, let me offer another one,
all right.
Just for the sake. What you're also saying is that a defendant standing in the position of Mr. Johnson has a right, has standing, renewed standing, to argue about, or to argue the illegality of conduct that did not affect his personal right.
But your opponent has tried to narrow this to the particular set of circumstances where there really is just one event, if you will, where you don't have separate actions or separable points, at which point I would assume the normal standing rules would kick back in and you wouldn't have this potential for exploitation.
Well, to respond to that, Your Honor, in every standing case, the independent events that make up the event are parsed.
and analyzed separately. I mean, that's a requirement of the standing rule. So to make that exception, I think, would even take you farther from an analytical way.
The Supreme Court doesn't even like standing analysis in Fourth Amendment cases. Their preferred way of looking at it is to see whether one has an expectation of privacy in the area or the circumstances at hand.
Well, that's the rule, and what I'm saying, what the government is arguing is that it's not necessary or appropriate to make an exception for the standing rules that pertain to every case.
So imagine a situation where you think there's a gang of 20 drug dealers. You're not sure. You just have a good hunch. So you arrest all 20. So illegal arrest, but you don't care about that because each defendant, you can use all the evidence from the other 19 against that defendant. So for each defendant, each of the 20, you have 90 illegally gathered bodies of evidence which you use against that person. So the only price is, you know, in each case the police lose 5% of the evidence. But in exchange, you know, they have a very successful mass arrest. They wouldn't have to worry anymore about probable cause for arrest in gang cases.
May I distinguish two facts in your scenario from the facts that apply in this case? First of all, in your scenario, everybody has been arrested illegally, whereas in this case, the original traffic stop was legal. So that's a big distinguishing factor.
No, that's not a big difference. You're going back and arguing about whether there were illegal arrests here.
Well, I think that I personally do think that is a good distinction. But another distinction is this.
How can it be a distinction? You didn't appeal the judge's ruling.
Okay. Well, no. The judge did not rule. The judge did not rule that the stop was unlawful. The judge ruled that the stop was lawful under Terry, and that the arrest, the subsequent search and arrest, were unlawful.
Well, that's what we're talking about. Illegal arrest. Who cares about the initial stop?
Well, what I'm saying is that in your scenario, everybody who is arrested has a complaint, has standing to raise the arrest from the beginning as to themselves.
What does it care whether it's the beginning or whether they're hit over the head 5 minutes later? I don't understand you.
Well, here's the other distinction that's important. In the case where there's 20 people standing on the street and each one has drugs in their pocket, there's no valid basis for holding accountable each and every one of the 19 people for the 20th person's pocket full of drugs. In this case,
whatever the evidence they have against the 20, suppose they have a little bit of evidence against each of the 20. It doesn't have to be drugs in their pockets. It can be money. It can be they're seen talking to each other, what have you. So whatever evidence they have against the 20, 19/20 of that evidence can be used against each of the defendants.
If it can be used.
Of course, it can be used under your view. Of course it can be used.
Well, I think that the reality, I mean, it would be silly to say that there isn't a reality here in terms of deterring police misconduct. But the point that I would make is that it's really no different than it is in every standing case. And that decision has been made for us. I mean, standing is required. And to say that it is required in a case where you've got one step in the analytical process, but it's not required when you have two.
No, we have standing here. You want to use, the problem is not standing. Johnson is trying to get rid of the evidence against him. And your argument is there's an independent source. And the question is, what is the scope of the independent source doctrine?
That's right. And if the independent source is illegality that the defendant has no standing to challenge, should it be considered?
And then it metamorphoses into legitimate evidence at that point. That's not a standing issue. He has a concrete stake in whether that evidence comes in.
Well, the question isn't whether the evidence comes in against him. The question is whether he has standing to challenge the illegal search and seizure of that evidence based on where and from whom it was seized. So, it's true in every case the defendant against whom evidence is going to be used has a stake. but steak isn't the same thing as in that context.
You know, Johnson is trying to exclude the evidence, his own evidence, right?
Well, Johnson's trying to exclude evidence that was seized in the car.
From him.
From him?
That is not a standing issue when he's challenging the
I agree, but as to the car, it is a standing issue. Because the car was searched as
but
a result
your argument of the arrest. But your argument is right. You think the drugs that were taken out of Johnson's pocket, they could be used against him, because of the independent source doctrine. That's not an issue that has anything to do with standing.
Well, I think Judge Wood, I think you put it most succinctly when you said, does the independent source rule or the inevitable discovery rule or the attenuation rule, whatever rule it is, require intervening legal conduct? That's the question. Or does it require illegal conduct that the particular defendant has a right to challenge under general standing principles? Those are the choices.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Bonamici.
Thank you.
Mr. Robbins, how much time did you have? 3 minutes? Do you have anything further?
4 minutes. Just briefly.
Just to clarify, it was Johnson's car.
It was Johnson's car.
Right.
He was the driver. He was at the wheel of park when the police pulled up. The only thing I think I would wish to emphasize at this point is that to the extent the standing is implicated here, because you do have other people who were searched, although as we've discussed contemporaneously with that of the illegal search of the defendant, so all the searches were illegal. So, of course, there is no independent source because there's no legal police conduct implicated in any of the searches. That's the ruling of the court. But further, to the extent that you're going to balance any other concern against the exclusionary rule, which, of course, is grounded in a concern about deterring police misconduct, you have to look at the police misconduct here. This is not a case, like many others, where the police exceeded the bounds inadvertently, where they're aggressive but good-intentioned, where they take somebody away 15 minutes from the scene before probable cause arises, or where they think they have a right to enter but they're a little bit premature. There is no good faith here. What the district court said was sworn officers have not sworn truthfully. To put it bluntly, this is perjury. That's what the district court found. And if anything needs to be deterred here, it's this kind of police misconduct, where they go out looking for evidence on a contrived stop, they find it, and then they give false testimony in a district court to justify what they found. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Robbins. And you were appointed, were you not?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, we thank you for accepting the appointment. And our next case.